Thanks again, Tom, Callie, and Debbie, and choir, filling our hearts with the precious truth of that. I remember that song from when I was a new Christian. It's so beautiful and fills my heart as I come up here to give you God's Word. Let me begin with a quote from author Paul Thigpen from the Discipleship Journal. He says, "My 5-year-old Lydia had been in bed an hour when I passed by the half-open door of her darkened room. She was weeping uncontrollably. 'Honey, what's wrong?' I asked, sitting on the edge of her bed and gently taking her hand. 'Have you had a bad dream?' Lydia tried to respond, but tears choked her words. I stroked her hair to soothe her. After a moment, she cried in little girl anguish, 'Oh, Daddy, I just want to see God.' Her words startled me. Now it was my turn to weep. I drew her close and said, 'Darling, do you know why you want to see God so much? Because that's the reason He made you. You were created to see God. And if you love Him with all your heart, one day you will see God face to face. That's His promise.' Comforted, she nodded her head, lay back down, and was soon fast asleep. After 16 years, I still find myself amazed at Lydia's words that night. In the depth of her 5-year-old soul, she had realized intuitively what theologians over the centuries have carefully reasoned out. In our hearts of hearts, we long above all things to see God face to face. God has made us for Himself, and we will be satisfied with nothing less than the unobscured sight of His face as we stand in His glorious presence. Beloved, we are God's children now. It does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when He appears, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is." 1 John 3:2. How excited do you get about the idea of seeing God? Do you think that that example is a little ridiculous, a little over the top, something you can't exactly identify with? I just want to see God. Maybe you think that the idea of Scripture of gazing upon God for eternity sounds a little to you like cable television. There are an infinite variety of choices and channels, but after a while you just want to get out and play. What do you think when you think of seeing God? It will not grip our hearts. It will not grip your heart. It will not grip my heart until you see that God Himself is the fountainhead of every good desire you have ever had. Every desire that you have ever had for beauty, for peace, for comfort, for truth, for delight, even for adventure. Those are all created experiences that you and I have. But God is the fountainhead, source of all those delights. He is the uncreated source. And so when Jesus says in the 6th Beatitude, we've been going through those and you see it on the background of the place possibly where He actually spoke those words on the hill beside the Galilean Sea. "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they are the ones who will see God." What do you think when He says pure in heart? What does that mean to you? Who here would say that your first thought is to think of how your heart is pure? Our first thought is to think of impurity, isn't it? We hear pure of heart and our mind immediately goes to how my heart is impure. I remember that Jesus as we talked about in the beginning of this series, is addressing our hearts. The series means nothing to you if you're not willing to honestly look at your heart. And so when Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart, you look at your heart and you realize your heart is impure. And so as you think of purity of heart and of your impurity, what is the first thing that comes to your mind? Let me suggest that your answer to that, which you probably wouldn't want anybody else here to know, is probably a clue to your most besetting life sin. What your mind leaps to at that moment is probably the thing that most in your heart keeps you from seeing God. What does pure in heart mean? What did Jesus mean when he said that? We don't have to guess. He tells us what makes our hearts impure in a number of places, but one of the best is Matthew chapter 15. Do you remember in Matthew chapter 15, the Jewish leaders were criticizing, particularly Jesus' disciples, saying, what's with these guys? They don't ceremonially wash their hands before they eat, breaking the law. And Jesus uses that criticism as an opportunity to teach them about purity. And he says, well, you know, it's really not what goes into the body that makes you pure. That just goes in and passes through. It's what comes out of your heart. That's what makes you impure. So as you see it up there on the screen, Jesus says in Matthew chapter 15, let me find it here, or else I'll have to turn to it. Let me just turn to it. In Matthew 15, but the things that come out of the mouth come from the heart, and these make a man unclean. I believe that what he gives here, there's seven things, and I believe there are three pairs with one extra that is fitted in there. For out of the heart come evil thoughts and murder, first pair, adultery, sexual immorality, second pair, theft, kind of stands alone, false testimony and slander, sins of the mouth, your speech. These are what make a man, a person, unclean. But eating with unwashed hands does not make him unclean. The issue is what comes out of the heart. Evil thoughts and murder, he says, wicked schemes that you justify to get your own way, using people for your own ends, murder, the extremes to which you would go if you were not restrained by law, other constraints, if you thought you could get away with it, but you murder the person in your heart. Jesus says that desire to destroy whatever gets in your way makes you impure. Adultery, sexual immorality in actions, or perhaps in thoughts for some of you, the actions that bring pain and shame as you remember them, or the thoughts fantasizing dozens of times a week, those things that you couldn't do. The things that are the imaginations of your heart that are impure. Jesus says this makes your heart impure. Or theft. Coveting what you don't have and believe that you deserve to have. And so you will scheme some way to get it from your boss, your employer. Something that nobody will notice. Taking software, whatever it is. Shoplifting with your friends in a store. Theft. Or maybe it's false testimony and slander. Twisting and manipulating the truth to make you look good or to accomplish what you want. Putting a spin on something. Or simply lying. Or gossiping. Tearing down someone else that's not present because of jealousy. Because of envy of them, or you want to get back at them. All these things make us squirm a little bit, don't they? Who here would say, they don't touch me? I'm pure in heart. But what does this have to do with seeing God? In our culture, we kind of believe that, well, sure, nobody's perfect. You know, God's job is to forgive that, right? God is supposed to love us unconditionally and say, that's okay, come on in. Jesus is actually here referring to a psalm, Psalm 24, which you see there on the screen, that says, who may ascend to the hill of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to an idol or swear by what is false. Now, if you just picture that for a moment, you can see why a pure heart goes with seeing God. Imagine coming to his holy hill, standing in his presence with bloody hands, a filthy heart, distracted from looking at him by the idols that you are lusting after and want to find satisfaction in instead of him. And then you speak to him lies as if you can deceive the one who knows your heart better than you do. You see, the very nature of coming in the presence of God requires a pure heart. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 9 says, who can say that I have a pure heart? And the verse right before that says, pictures a king. When a king sits on his throne to judge, he winnows out all evil with his eyes. So Solomon here is picturing a human king, a person of authority, who when you come before him, you tremble a little bit, and with his piercing gaze, he convicts you to tell the truth. He winnows out the truth with his gaze. Now, the next verse is, who can say, I have kept my heart pure, I am clean and without sin? Picture yourself standing before the sovereign creator of the universe, king of all reality, created and uncreated, and he winnows out the truth with his eyes. Who can come before him and claim purity? Even David, described as the man after God's own heart, after his adultery with Bathsheba, prayed, create in me a clean heart, O God. I don't have a clean heart. Isaiah, in his vision in the temple, when he saw God high and lifted up, said, oh God, I'm a man of unclean lips and I dwell among a people who have filthy lips because my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. A glimpse of God causes you and me to be profoundly aware of our impurity. The fact that none of us has a pure heart doesn't bring us comfort, as if God grades on a curve. You say, well, you know, we're all impure, so he's got to let somebody through. Oh, no. Such a hope is entirely in vain. There is only one way that Jesus is able to say, blessed are the pure in heart. I mean, why say blessed are the pure in heart? If nobody's pure in heart, nobody will be blessed. Remember, it's the sixth beatitude, so you've got to go back to the foundation where Jesus had said, first of all, blessed are those who are poor in spirit, who acknowledge their spiritual bankruptcy. If you're here this morning and you're denying your spiritual bankruptcy, you're denying the impurity of your heart, you will not be blessed. There's only that fearful looking for what you deserve. But he says, blessed are those who admit their spiritual bankruptcy and then don't just admit it, but mourn it. Grieve over what your heart is like. And that gentles you, he says in the third place. And that gentleness is expanded to a new hunger and thirst for righteousness. And that hunger and thirst for righteousness issues in three particulars. Last week, a merciful heart, because you've received mercy. And here he says, a pure heart, who understands purity. You are pure only because you have been purified by the Pure One. That's the third point. You are purified by the Pure One, or else you are hopeless. Now, a good place to see that is in Hebrews chapter 7. In Hebrews chapter 7, the author is contrasting Jesus as the high priest with the earthly high priests who lived and died and had a very limited effect to their priesthood. But as you see up there from Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 26, Jesus is described such a high priest. He meets our need, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Then he goes on to describe what he does. In verse 27, unlike the other high priest, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself, the pure for the impure. And it goes back to what we talked about before in hungering and thirsting for righteousness. Jesus traded records with you. Jesus' heart is pure. Your heart is impure. Jesus took the record of your impure heart, your thefts, your murders, your adulteries, your sexual immoralities, your slandering, your gossip, your evil schemes, your lying. He took all that upon himself and died, paying the price of God's judgment and wrath for all those things. And then he gives you his record, his pure heart. And that pure heart is imputed to you. You know what that means? That means when you look at the Beatitudes, if you were to list them, you have one column here. Here's the Beatitudes, all the things Jesus describes. And even though he accomplished all those things perfectly, the Beatitudes describe Jesus. He is judged on the cross as if he had broken every single one. And on this side is your record. And because Jesus has imputed to you, God has imputed to you for Jesus, his record. You look at those Beatitudes, and in God's judgment, you check each one off. You put your name there. Poor in spirit, check. Mourn, check. Gentle, check. Hunger and thirst for righteousness, check. Merciful, pure in heart, check. That's good news, isn't it? I mean, that makes you want to stand up and shout. I know you won't. You'll constrain yourself. But that you are accounted pure in heart. But now what Jesus is talking about, blessed are the pure in heart, is not simply a purity that's imparted, it's imputed. It's also a purity that is imparted. It's a purity that he begins to work out. He gives you a new heart. And the deepest desires of that new heart is to see him, to love him, to serve him. But you still have the corruption of the old heart. And that old heart veils the desire, the longing, the ability to see him. So there's a spiritual conflict that's going on, right? I even as I say this, you say, yeah, part of me identifies with that little girl. Part of me, but you know, a big part of me doesn't. I sort of, yeah, but no, 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 back and forth. And so, the author of Hebrews goes on chapter 12, and he says, strive for holiness, that is purity, without which no one will see the Lord. So on the one hand, you're given a pure heart. On the other hand, you strive for a purer heart. See, both those things are true in the Christian life. Purity imputed, purity imparted. And so Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. That's the blank, by the way. We also strive for the holiness. Fourth point. So what does the promise mean, and how are these things connected to purity of heart and the seeing God? Two ways. First of all, they're connected ultimately. All the Beatitudes have both the idea of ultimately in heaven and temporally in this world. And so in this, the promise ultimately is of heaven. Heaven is not just a place where the battle is done, where you can rest, where you can feast without gaining weight, where you can sit on the beach and not burn, where you can take risks and not get hurt. Kind of like the song, you know, Brad Paisley and Dolly Parton, "When I Get Where I'm Going." You know, you've heard that. He goes through, you know, "And I'm going to spread my wings and fly. I'm going to ride a drop of rain. I'm going to see my old granddaddy. I'm going to run my fingers through the mane of my old horse up there." You know, that's why people picture heaven. You get through the whole song. It's not a word about Jesus. Just what I can do, all things I want to do. Jesus saying, heaven is not heaven without Jesus. Heaven is not heaven if you don't see God's face. And so in heaven, of all the things that you look for, the chief delight is to see his face. What's the thing that you most delight in looking at here on earth? Maybe some of you think about something you have or maybe look forward to. I think for most of us, it's going to be a person. You know, some of you young people, you think of the girlfriend or boyfriend, you think, "Oh man, I just love to look at his face, love to look at her face." Hopefully, those of us married could say, "I'd love to look at my wife's face, my husband's face, my kid's face, my parents' face," you know, whatever. It always amazes me after 38 years how I'm still intrigued with looking at my wife Kathy's face and how many different expressions the human face can have, isn't it? Just the eyes. I think she has 500 different looks in her eyes, you know. Some are delightful, some of them not so good, but, you know, there is that seemingly infinite variety of looking at a person's face. And that's just a few square inches of physical flesh. What is it like to see God's face? What is it like to look at him? You know, Revelation chapter 22 describes the delights of heaven, describes the river of pure, crystal clear water, the trees that are bearing all kinds of fruits, and talks about it's a place where there's no more pain or any of this. But the climax of it, Revelation chapter 22, you see it there in verse 4. The climax of it, he describes, is that they will see his face and his name will be on their foreheads. That's the climax. You and I will see the fountainhead of all delights. And Jesus, in his prayer for us, prayed, "Father, I long for you to bring them to be with me so that they may behold my glory." John 17, 24. Because he knows that beholding his glory is transfixing to each of us. It's the chief of all delights. And that's heaven. And heaven will involve a lot of activities, not just passive gazing. A lot of things, but in everything you do and I do, all the creative activities and all the tremendous things we'll enjoy, always there is the image of his face. There is the awareness of his presence and nothing to separate us. But that's not just for heaven. It's also here and now. It begins here. And so you and I get by the first fruits of the Spirit, the beginning experience of what we're going to experience then. And so Jesus says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." They will see here and now, not just then. James 4 talks about how as we put away our idols, James 4, 8, we draw near to God. He draws near to you and to me. And let me state a general principle here. In general, I would say you and I see God just as much as we want to. Another idea of that word purity is single, undiluted. Talk about pure gold, unalloyed, just pure, single. You talk about Mary offering her nard. It was pure nard, wasn't diluted. So pure also has the idea of focused, single, pure, undiluted. And the more you desire to see him, the more you'll see him. Now, the exception to that is those temporary times where called the dark night of the soul, where like Job, he hides himself from you. That will happen. It happens to all of us. But in general, there is the increasing experience, sometimes from time to time, here and there, of seeing him. As you set your heart on that. Now, one thing that gave me an insight into this was an article I read back in 1982. That's a long time ago. The author in that article said something that has stuck with me for all these years. It was a very long article. It was in Leadership Magazine, one of the few articles they ever republished, and they got more response to this article than anything else they have ever published. It was a story anonymously given of a pastor who was in bondage to the addiction of pornography for 10 years and lived a double life. He describes how he went step by step lower and lower into this bondage. He goes into great detail. And he talks about how one time, after many years, he couldn't stand it any longer and he shared it with another pastor. The other pastor, he said, broke down and wept and sobbed. And he was struck by how much his sin had affected the other pastor until he realized the other pastor was praying for himself, for he realized he was in worse bondage. And he says, a month after my conversation with my friend, I began reading a brief and simple book of memoirs, What I Believe, by François Mauriac. In this book by the prize-winning Nobel Prize-winning author, he describes through another novel he'd written, Viper's Tangle, the kind of addiction to pornography and sexual perversions that went beyond what this pastor had ever experienced. And so he said, I knew that whatever he found, he was a man who could speak to my heart. And in this book, he had a chapter on purity. After brazenly denying the most common reasons I have heard against succumbing to a life filled with lust, Mauriac concludes that there is only one reason to seek purity. It is the reason Christ proposed in the Beatitudes. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Purity, says Mauriac, is the condition for a higher love, for a possession superior to all possessions, God himself. Mauriac goes on to describe how most of our arguments for purity are negative. Be pure or you will feel guilty, or your marriage will fail, or you'll be punished. But the Beatitudes clearly indicate a positive argument that fits neatly with the Bible's pattern for describing sin. The thought hit me like a bell rung in a dark, silent hall. So far, none of the scary negative arguments against lust had succeeded in keeping me from it. Fear and guilt simply didn't give me resolve. They added self-hatred to my problems. But here was a description of what I was missing by continuing to harbor lust. I was limiting my intimacy with God. The love he offers is so transcendent and possessing that it requires our faculties to be purified and cleansed before we can possibly contain it. Could he, in fact, substitute another thirst, another hunger for the one that I had never filled? Would living water somehow quench lust? That was the gamble of faith. Perhaps Mauriac's point seemed obvious and predictable to people who respond to anguished problems with spirit-sounding cliches, but I knew Mauriac and his life well enough to know that his observation was the culmination of a lifetime of struggle. He had come to that conclusion as the only possible justification for abstemiousness. Perhaps, just perhaps, the discipline and commitment involved in somehow allowing God to purge out the impurities formed the sine qua non, the essential first step toward a relationship with God I had never known. And then skipping to the end, he concludes, I have learned that Mauriac was right. God has kept his part of the bargain. In a way I had never known before, I have come to see God. God delivered him out of this addiction. At times, not so often, maybe every couple of months, I have had an experience with God that has stunned me with its depth and intimacy, an experience of an order I did not even know before existed. Some of these moments have come during prayer and Bible reading, some during deep conversations with other people, and one the most memorable of all because of my occupation was while I was speaking at a Christian conference. At such moments, I have felt possessed, but this time, joyfully. Demonic possession is a poor parody for the filling of the Spirit. They have left me shaken and humbled, renewed and cleansed. I had not known that level of mystical experience, had not in fact even sought it except in the general way of seeking purity. God has revealed himself to me. The city of God is taking on bricks and mortar. Psalm 27, which I wish I could conclude with, don't have time to look at it. David there talks about seeing God in terms of the comfort, the delight, the gentleness in times of trouble. Do you, in your heart, want for him to work in you, to see him, to experience him in a way you never have before? For some of you guys, you identify with this story, we have a sexual addiction support group, Thursday evening, Z53. Come, talk to me, ask me about it. Nobody knows who's in that group. I don't know who's in that group. Or you can put it on your gray slip. We'll simply forward it on. But seeing God is such a blessing. Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart. And you and I just begin to experience the depths of what that blessing means. Let's come to him in prayer now. Lord, we come and we want to claim that promise. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. We want to know more what that means. We want to come so that we're able to say, Lord, hungering and seeing you, seeing something of what you are like, your character, your gentleness, your faithfulness, to see who you are is worth letting go of all those things that are impurities and block veil that sight. And so, Lord, work in us. Work in us that we will bring those, lay them at your feet. Come to Jesus for the purity imputed and the purity imparted to us, that we would relish and know more of the blessing that you promise here. We ask that in Jesus' name.